We're just continuing our discussion of korbanos. Remember, we talked about the korban chatas, and there's the regular korban chatas, and then there is what is called the asham taloi, which is when you don't know if you committed a sin. And then we talked about the ola v'yore chatas, the one that goes up and down. That is the variable chatas. It's a korban chatas. And that is brought for someone who goes into the Beis HaMikdash when they are Tamei, or the Temple Mount, and for someone who eats Korbanos when they are Tamei, or somebody who violates their Shavua and the like. So here the Torah gives you three choices based on your income. You either bring the regular goat or sheep, or if you can't afford it, you bring the birds, or you could even bring flour, a meal offering. But remember, this is not an option that is available for all sins. This is only available for those specific sins of Tumah in the Beis HaMikdash, or eating the Korbanos, or false oaths and the like. Now let me just mention, there's one other type of chatas to be aware of, and that is, this is a very, very, very interesting issue. That is, what if the Jewish people sinned not because of their mistake, but because of a mistake of the Sanhedrin? Let's say the Sanhedrin made a decision that a certain activity was permitted. By the Sanhedrin, we're talking about the 70 members of the Sanhedrin. And most of the Jewish people followed that decision of the Sanhedrin. And the Sanhedrin then concludes that it made a mistake, and what they permitted should actually be forbidden. So here we have two interesting halachas. Rule number one is, the individuals who transgress do not have to bring a sin offering, because they are not responsible for their mistake, because they made a mistake based on the Sanhedrin. But number two, the Sanhedrin must bring a sin offering. And this is a totally different chatas. This is actually totally burnt. This is not eaten by the Kohanim at all. And the term for this, and it's a bull instead of a sheep or a goat, and this goes by the name par, the bull, helem davar, of inadvertence on the part of the congregation that followed the decision of the Beis Din. And the rules of that sacrifice are totally different, but it's very peculiar. It's limited to the Sanhedrin, and it's limited to where most of the people followed the decision. If only a minority followed the decision, then nobody brings a sin offering. The individuals don't bring it because they were following the Sanhedrin. But the Sanhedrin doesn't bring it because most of the congregation did not follow them. So par helem davar requires two conditions: that it be a decision of the Sanhedrin, and that it be followed by most of the congregation.
I thought you said, like, in the past, like, when they make a decision, that it goes, like,
yeah, so that's a very excellent question. This is really a very, very interesting, difficult philosophical question, and that is, how is it possible that the Sanhedrin is in error? Meaning, even if they misinterpreted the halacha, so in some abstract way they got it wrong, that becomes the will of God. So if that becomes the will of God, meaning if they permitted something that was really treif, but by virtue of their permitting it, that becomes the spiritual reality. So even if later they're going to say, well, we made a mistake and from now on this product should be treif, one might have assumed that doesn't change the past. And at the time when people transgressed, so to speak, they were not transgressing. Right? That's your question. A very excellent question. Meaning, the whole metzias of declaring that some type of sacrifice is necessary because of a mistake seems to be contradicted by the notion that the Sanhedrin Pesach changes the reality. If you remember, the Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah talks about the fact that the Sanhedrin once proclaimed the wrong day as Rosh Hashanah, meaning it was not the day that the moon actually appeared. And therefore Yom Kippur would be a different day than the astronomical calendar. And Rabbi Gamliel, the head of the Sanhedrin, ordered Rabbi Yehoshua to come to him on the day that was Rabbi Yehoshua's Yom Kippur. And Rabbi Yehoshua didn't want to do that, and Rabbi Akiva told him, I'm sorry, even when the Sanhedrin makes the wrong day, the holiday, that becomes the holiday. It is a very excellent question. The only answer we could give really is that if the Sanhedrin themselves conclude they made a mistake, then they basically say we were wrong, meaning no other Sanhedrin, a later Sanhedrin, would not have been able to do that. But when the court itself that issued the decision said we were mistaken, they are withdrawing the spiritual transformations that were in effect by their psak. So par helem davar would be limited to where the same Sanhedrin that issued the decision concludes that their decision was an error.
Yeah. Is that not the same as the lice thing today, though, that we found something out that they don't reproduce?
Well, that's a good question, and there is a debate, but the Rav Dessler writes that the Sanhedrin or Chazal may have had many, many reasons for halachas, and even if they only gave you one reason that's proven to be wrong, that does not undermine the other reasons, some of which are not told to us, and therefore we assume the halacha stands even if the reason falls. But once again, I'll give you the same answer. When the very Sanhedrin that issued the ruling says we were wrong, then whatever reasons they had, they're saying are all wrong. You see, we cannot say they're wrong because they may have had other reasons. But they could say they're wrong because they knew all the reasons that they had. Yeah?
If you say when the Beis Din makes a decision to change, it like changes the spiritual reality.
Yeah.
Then why is it that the people who did brought sacrifices, that they were mistaken per se? Like, they should be rewarded. It shouldn't be, they should be sacrifices because they were doing a mitzvah at that time.
Well, they don't bring a sacrifice. Again, they do not bring it. It is the Sanhedrin that brings it. That's very important. You're 100% correct. The individuals who followed the decision of the Sanhedrin do not have to bring sacrifices. This is an obligation on the Sanhedrin themselves. Yeah.
Do we know any examples of this happening?
Well, I'm not aware of a concrete example. The Torah discusses it, and again, there's a whole Maseches Horius, which deals with hypothetical cases, but I'm not aware of historically an actual case where the Sanhedrin revoked its decision. Yeah.
Is this the fourth type of Ola Vioret?
No. This has nothing to do. No. This is not an Ola Vioret. This is a fixed korban, and this is a par. It is a bull.
Fixed korban.
Fixed meaning it's not a variable. Ola Vioret is a variable offering, meaning animal, bird, or flower. This is a fixed, meaning it does not change with the. First of all, you have 70 people bring it, so it's hard to know, rich, poor, etc. But this is a bull that everybody brings. 70, the 70 elders bring, and all of them have to lay their hands on the bull. You know, they have to confess their sin on the par and the like. Okay?
What is the name of it?
It's called Par Helem Davar. Hey, Ayin, Lamed, Final Mem. And davar is the second word, dalet beis reish, and that means the bull of concealment. Meaning concealment means mistaken, erroneous law. And again, need to emphasize this is not the responsibility of the individual Jews who transgressed. This is the responsibility of the Sanhedrin themselves, who issued a halachic ruling in error. Yeah.
If there were a kohen on the Sanhedrin, would that be the one that would bring the actual?
In other words, would he be the one who actually brought the korban?
Yeah.
He could, but it wouldn't have to be him. Any kohen is good enough. It doesn't have to be the kohen, but certainly he would be permitted to do it.
Because you think that would be more.
Yeah. But I guess, I mean, let me give you another example. I mean, let's say a kohen, an individual kohen, not a sin, is bringing his own private sin offering. He also doesn't have to be the one that brings it. He could give it to another kohen to sacrifice it. So this would be the same idea. Okay, yeah.
This is just, I remember a couple years ago, there was a whole thing in Muncie that came out with a person who was selling.
He was selling, a kosher butcher was selling treif meat.
Yeah. Came out, and so I remember, so I think Rabbi Tatz was talking about, not specifically about that, but when a person consumes that, they don't get like onish for eating treif, but it still harms them in some way spiritually.
Yes.
Though they didn't mean to. So aren't Am Yisrael in some way still harmed by doing something that they weren't supposed to do?
So here we have to differentiate different situations. If I buy meat from a butcher that is certified kosher, and it turns out to be treif, so Rabbi Tatz's point is correct, that even though I didn't commit a sin, God is not going to punish me for a sin because I had the right to assume it was kosher. But l'maisa, I ingested spiritual poison, so my neshama does get hurt one way or the other. By contrast, when we're dealing with a decision of the Sanhedrin, that's why I use that lashon, the Sanhedrin has a power to literally change the spiritual reality. So the issue that you're raising, that even unintentional sin for which I'm not accountable in any way, again, poison is a perfect analogy. I don't want to scare you, if I buy a bottle of soda, a bottle of juice, or a carton of milk, and there happens to be arsenic in it, and I drink it, now, I'm not punished because I'm drinking arsenic, in other words, but I ingested the poison, so it's going to affect me. So unintentional violations of kashrut may not be sins. They're not sinful. They're not violations. They're not going to be punished by God. But it does affect you because you've taken in poison. But Sanhedrin is a different dynamic. Sanhedrin can literally change the DNA.
So
it works on a spiritual molecular level, so to speak, in which it doesn't even have that negative effect. Yeah.
So like if the Sanhedrin were to say this coke has no arsenic in it, it would all of a sudden have no arsenic.
Well, yes, there are teachings like that. In fact, I'll tell you a story. Again, it's a story. It may not even be true, but this is a maysa they tell. That, you know, there is a concept of hilchos treifos, meaning if animals have certain defects in their internal organs, even if they're shechted, you're not allowed to eat them. That's why when an animal is shechted, we check the lungs to be sure there are no adhesions, no perforations, and the like. Now, the rule is, when an animal is, in fact, we use treif to mean non-kosher, but technically, treifa refers to these types of perforations in the internal organs. So, the Gemara says, if an animal is in a condition of treifa, it could not live for more than a year. Okay, that's the rule. So, occasionally, there are machloksim among the poskim, if certain defects render an animal treifa or not treifa. So apparently, in the city of Volozhin, when the Shagas Aryeh was the Rebbe, he was the Rav of Volozhin before Rav Chaim of Volozhin. Shagas Aryeh was a very, very famous Gadol. The Shagas Aryeh ruled that a certain defect was not a treifa, and you could eat the meat. In the rest of Europe, the Poskim ruled, it was a treifa, and you cannot eat the meat. So in Volozhin, they actually had a psak allowing people to eat meat that would be treifa, literally, any other city. So the story goes that there was a man that had a certain lung condition that was identical to this animal condition. And the man wanted to go to a better climate because it would help his recovery. So the Sagas Aryeh told him, you better not leave the city. Why is that? Because Chazal say that if something is a treifa, it cannot live for more than a year. As long as you're in Volozhin, you're not a treifa. If you leave Volozhin, you become a treifa, and you will not be able to live more than a year. So the person thought this was ridiculous. I am either sick or I'm not sick, but I'm not going to, my condition is not going to become a terminal illness because I leave the city of Volozhin. But no, he left to the city of Volozhin to go to a better climate, and he died within the year. Which kind of means, you would have thought this condition is a metzias. Either it'll kill me in a year or it won't kill me in a year. It says, no, in Volozhin, you're not a trefa. Outside of Volozhin, you will become a trefa. So there is that concept of psak, changing reality. Now, that does raise some interesting questions. I mean, let's talk about the Sanhedrin for a moment. Let's say, what is my responsibility as an individual if I know that they're wrong? Let's say Sanhedrin inspected a factory, although this is normally not their job, and they say this factory produces a kosher product. Now, if you're a regular individual and you don't know one way or the other, you have a 100% right to follow that decision. And even if it turns out to be wrong, you have no sin. And I even mentioned you have no spiritual poison. The Sanhedrin changed the reality. If they later decide that there was a mistake, they have to bring the korban. You don't have to bring the korban. All of that is simple. But here's my question. Okay, that's fine for the guy who doesn't know. But what if I know? I know, he says, I know they put in some pork there this morning. But the Sanhedrin ignored them. Am I allowed to eat it? Now, one might have thought, maybe, if you take the spiritual DNA reversal seriously, that they change the Messiah, one might have thought that even the guy that knows it's treif might be allowed to eat it because Sanhedrin said it's okay. And yet, that seems to be not the halacha. The halacha seems to be pretty clear that the guy who knows, now this is such an interesting thing, the guy who knows is not allowed to tell other people that it's treif. It's very interesting. He's not allowed to tell people not to follow the Sanhedrin, because that's called rebelliousness against the Sanhedrin. But he himself is obligated to act according to his knowledge. Now, I don't mean his opinion. If, for example, there's a machlokas in halacha, and I think the Sanhedrin got the halacha wrong, I'm not supposed to follow my opinion. But if it's a question of fact, that there's chazer here, then I am, in other words, so it's a little inconsistent. So it doesn't totally change the metzias, in the sense that the person who knows is mechuyev to be machmer. But Lagabe, at least the people who don't know, there is no spiritual damage to them. Okay, so again, there are so many details, I don't want to overwhelm you with detail after detail, but at least you should be aware of the basic types of sin offerings there are. There is the regular sin offering, there is the Asham Taloi, there is the Ola V'Yoreit, and there's the Par Helem Dover. So I think we covered four basic sin offerings.
I don't think we're doing the types of sins on the Ola V'Yoreit. I don't think we got to the fourth one.
Yeah. The fourth one is also okay. So I mentioned entering the Temple Mount when you're Tamei, and eating korbanos when you're Tamei. The third is false oaths. Now the fourth is also a special type of false oath. It's not so clear why it's mentioned separately. But this is an oath to come to a Beis Din and testify. So let's say I'm suing somebody, and I think that you and somebody else have testimony that could help me. So I administer an oath to you, and I say that if you know something about my case, I hereby make you swear that you will come and testify in my behalf. And then they don't show up, even though they knew something about the case. So they are chayav an Ola V'Yoreit sin offering. Now, why isn't that just another form of false oath? Because I swore I would come to court and I didn't show up. You could have subsumed that under the other category. That's another question. But the Torah does put it in two different categories. And the Rishonim go into why. So those are the four cases of Ola V'Yoreit. Okay. So far we've discussed two types of korbanos, the burnt offering and the sin offering, for which we gave many types. Okay? Now let's mention a third offering, and that is the peace offering, the shlamim. The shlamim. And the peace offering is not brought for sin, but the peace offering is brought as a gift to God. Now, of course, as we explained, God does not need these gifts, but I need the gift. I need to express my love of God. And one of the ways I express my love of God is bringing a peace offering. Now, there is no such thing as an obligatory peace offering. You see, an ola can be obligatory, like the Karban Tamid, or it can be a nedava, a free will. A chatas can only be obligatory. You either have to bring it or you're not allowed to bring it. Shlamim is only free will. There is no place in the Torah where the Torah says you must bring a peace offering. Right? So, ola can be both. Chatas can only be obligatory. And shlamim can only be discretionary. I designate an animal, I want to bring it as a shlamim. Yeah.
Does it say in the davening somewhere that that when they do korbanos, it's like it brings a certain kind of smell or something?
Yes. Well, the chumash calls korbanos a pleasant fragrance to God, reyach nichoach. But the Ramban explains, it's not that God likes the smell of burnt meat, but rather the fact that you want to show your love and appreciation to Hashem.
So why does he say that?
No, because that's what it means. In other words, the korban smells good to God, not because of the smell, but because of the fact that you're bringing the korban to Hashem.
And it's bringing you closer to Hashem.
That's right, that's right. That's what korban means. Korban means closeness. Now, what you need to know about a shlamim is shlamim comes in two varieties. There's like vanilla and chocolate. There is the plain shlamim, and then there's a shlamim, you might call it on steroids, that goes by its own name, korban toda, the Thanksgiving offering. But the toda is actually a subcategory of shlamim, right? There's vanilla, plain vanilla shlamim. And then when you have a particular occasion of Thanksgiving, like the birth of a child or recovery from illness, you bring the shlamim in a different fashion that is called korban toda. Okay, but toda halachically is a form of shlamim. So first let me just mention the basic peace offering. A person brings the animal. The blood is sprinkled on the altar. The fats are burnt on the altar, like the chatas. But the meat of a shlamim is treated very differently. The meat of the shlamim is eaten in a two-way partnership. Part of the meat is eaten by the kohanim, and part of the meat is eaten by the Israel and his family who brought the korban. See, unlike the sin offering, you'll recall, all the meat is only eaten by the kohanim. In the case of a shlamim, the internal fats and organs are burnt on the altar like a sin offering. The meat is eaten by kohanim and by Yisrael. In fact, part of why it's called shlamim is it makes peace because everybody gets involved in the eating. Yeah.
When you say Yisrael, does that exclude
Levine
from something?
No. Whoever is bringing the korban.
Okay.
And that includes his wife and his children. Doesn't have to be only male. Chatas can only be eaten by kohanim who are male. The shlamim meat can be eaten by women, children, etc. Now, they have to be tahor. If they're impure, you'll recall, that's a sin for which you bring the korban ola v'yored. But assuming they're tahor, they can eat the korbanot. Okay. Now, a korban toda is exactly the same with the following additional difference. When you bring a korban toda, in addition to the animal, you actually bring 40 loaves of bread. And the bread is baked in different ways. 30 of them are unleavened bread, different types of matzah, and 10 of them are actually chametz. 10 of them are chametz, 40 loaves of bread, or matzah, you know, there'd be 30 matzos baked in different ways, and 10 chametz, which is very unusual because it's very interesting. Normally, the Beis HaMikdash is a chametz-free zone, even during the year. The exception is the 10 of the breads of chametz, which is why you cannot bring a korban todah during Pesach, because a korban todah requires 10 chametz sticka loaves, which you're not allowed to have. And then you take some of the loaves, are given to Kohanim as a gift to them, and the rest are eaten, just like the meat is split, the loaves are split as well. The Netziv points out, this is called Lachme Toda, the breads of the Korban Toda. The Netziv points out, why so much bread? Because you have so much bread, you have to invite a lot of people to this meal. It can't just be the family, unless you have a big family. And there is a concept, when you express gratitude to the Almighty, the more the merrier. You want to have more people participate in your meal. And the Torah didn't want to tell the person, you got to bring 5 animals, that would be too expensive, but at least bring a lot of good fancy bread there so people could enjoy. And this is the source of the concept that, you know, what is the, we actually do have an equivalent of a Korban Todah today in the sense of making the Gomel blessing, right? You're familiar with when you bench Gomel? Many people, most people here, when you make an overseas trip, you bench Gomel. Huh? Say again?
That is done on Shabbos.
That is done on Shabbos. Yeah, yeah. There's a discussion about that. But Gomel is the prayer. It's a good question. Gomel is the prayer that is our substitute for the Korban Todah. So just as one would bring a Korban Todah, a woman after childbirth, or a person who recovers from the hospital stay, or if you were out of jail, Jonathan Pollard, you know, that would bench a Gomel, or you survived an accident, or a tragic mishap. So in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, you would bring a Korban Todah. Today, we do not have a Beis HaMikdash yet, so we make the Gomel blessing to take the place of the Korban Todah. But you know, Gomel can be made only if there is at least a minyan of people. You cannot make the Gomel blessing with less than a minyan. That's why it's our custom to do it, you know, during Torah reading. But it doesn't have to be Torah reading. It could be any time. It could be at home. It could be at night. But it has to have, you know, you and 9 other people, because that's the whole concept. The whole concept of the Korban Todah is you give thanks to God in a multitude of people. And that's why we have so much bread, because it kind of forces you to invite everybody you know. Yeah.
And why within 3 days?
Well, a Korban Todah, you're talking about the benching of Gomel?
Yes.
Well, it's a good point, because a Korban Todah doesn't have that limitation, but apparently the feeling was that we want you to recite the bracha with a complete gratitude in your heart. And unfortunately, even when a very good thing happened to me, you know, some of the gratitude wears off in time. So we want you to make the bracha when your gratitude is the highest and the strongest. Okay? So Gomel itself is a rabbinic rule. I mean, the Torah does not mandate the benching of Gomel, but the rabbis enacted Gomel based on the model of the Korban Todah. Now, if you recall, in Psukei Dezimra every morning after the Hodu, before Yehi Kavod, we say Mizmor Kuf, Tehillim 100, which is Mizmor LeTodah. This was the song that was sung in the Beis HaMikdash when you brought a Korban Todah. That's why we don't say Mizmor LeSoda on Pesach, and we don't even say it Erev Pesach, because they didn't bring a Korban Todah on Erev Pesach either, because early on Erev Pesach we have to stop eating chametz, so the Todah was not brought Erev Pesach either. Yeah.
And never mind, I forgot.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the idea of a Korban Todah. Very good kasha the Chassam Sofer asks is this: we paskin that the Gomel bracha can be made at night. As long as you have a minyan, you can make the bracha even at night, but a korban cannot be brought at night. Right? So there's a whole kasha. Again, it's similar to your kasha. How could I make hagomel on Shabbos if the korban toda was not brought on Shabbos, which you're correct? And it's the same question of night. So apparently Chazal did not make an absolute one-to-one correlation. Yeah. In fact, you make gomel on Pesach also. That's another kasha. I don't say Mizmor Lasoda on Pesach because there's no korban toda on Pesach, but I bench gomel if I came back on the trip. Chalomoi. Yeah. So there are some kashas that there.
Was that put in after the destruction of the second temple?
Yes. Gomel is really from the time of the Mishnah, which was written after the Churban, right? This was designed to be a bracha that took the place of the korban toda. Okay. So. Now, hopefully you have at least a bit of a picture. So we have the Ola, we have the many types of Chatas, we have the Shlamim, and then we have a subdivision of Shlamim, which is Korban Toda. Now, there are some mysteries, really. We don't really have a full explanation. Let me just mention this. When you bring a regular Shlamim, you have 2 days and a night to finish it off. Meaning, if you bring it Monday, you can eat it Monday night, and Tuesday until sunset. That's called 2 days and one night. If you bring a korban toda, even though there's more food there, right, there's more to eat, you only have a day and a night. You have Monday night, but you got to finish it before Tuesday morning. So I do not have a full explanation for all of this, but a toda has a less of a permissible time period of consumption than does the shlamim. Maybe the concept is that'll force you to invite more people. Again, maybe it's a mechanism that if you have less time to eat it, you need to have more people come, and that's the concept that one expresses their gratitude to Hashem, Barov Am. You know, there's a custom, it's not a din, that if something very, if something good has happened, in addition to benching gomel, which is maybe an obligation, people make either a kiddush or a meal to express gratitude. You've heard this is called seudas hoda'ah. And that's a very, very proper and good thing to do, because once again, one is expressing gratitude to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in a public and open forum. And that's a very, very proper midah to have. And that's even true if it's not a gomel occasion. For example, let's say you, whatever it is, let's say you graduated college, or you got your smicha, or you got a promotion, or whatever it would be. It's not something you bench gomel for, although maybe if you graduate college, maybe you ought to bench gomel. You're out of a dangerous situation. Whatever it would be. But you know, it's okay to make a seudas hodah for like any occasion. Because it is always good to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So even if it's not one of those things that you actually make a bracha with Hashem's name, but a seudas hodah is a nice idea. You move into a new home, right? So that's called Chanukah Sabayis, but really Chanukah Sabayis is a subcategory of a seudas hodah, some type of meal where you express gratitude to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay? So those, I think, are the basic korbanos you need to know, and hopefully the details will become clearer to you when we have the Beis HaMikdash, and you can actually go down the block there, go down, and you will be able to see these korbanos being brought. So let me emphasize that the korbanos are brought in the courtyard of the temple. Now, they're not brought in the temple building. The temple building, we brought incense. That was the one korban that was brought there. But all the korbanos are in the open-air courtyard. And as long as you're tahor, and when we have a Beis HaMikdash, you will be ritually tahor when you're sprinkled with the Parah Aduma ashes, you can watch those korbanos. You can actually come to the temple courtyard, even if you're not a Kohen, and you will be able to watch these korbanos being brought. Yeah.
The courtyard was only 50 cubits by 50 cubits?
No, well, it depends. In the Mishkan, it is 100 by 50 cubits. Yeah, the Beis HaMikdash is much, much bigger.
Oh.
Yeah. The dimensions in the Torah are the Mishkan dimensions, not the Beis HaMikdash dimensions. Yeah.
So we went through three types of korbanos.
Basically, we went through Ola, Chatas, Shlamim. Right. A lot. Now, the Chatas has many, many subcategories.
Right.
And the Shlamim has the Toda subcategory.
How many categories are there?
Well, there are another two categories. There's the Korban Asham, which is a guilt offering. Maybe we'll get to it. I'm not sure. I have to debate whether I'm giving you too many details. Yeah.
Where do we get the blueprint for the Beis HaMikdash?
Okay, so we get the blueprint. In the Book of Kings, the Book of Malachim, we are given the blueprint of the first temple, which is Solomon's temple, Shlomo's temple. Okay? In the Book of Yechezkel, we are given the blueprint of the third Beis HaMikdash, which is going to be the one that we get. The blueprint for the second Beis HaMikdash is not recorded in Tanakh, but it is recorded in Mishnayos, Maseches Midos, which is not about character. Midos means dimensions, is the blueprint of the second Beis HaMikdash.
Is it designed by man, or is it from God somehow? Like
it was by prophecy also. Prophecy. But the details of the prophecy are not in Tanakh, but Chazal recorded what it was. They just recorded it, and we know that the second Beis HaMikdash was inaugurated by Nevi'im, Chagai, Zechariah, Malachi, so they were doing it through prophecy.
Is it in Shas?
Maseches Midos. If you look, there's no Gemara on Maseches Midos. It's only Mishnayos, but it's in the order Kadshim, and it's in the volume of called Bechoros. It's a Mishnayos, Maseches Midos. Yeah.
I was just wondering, do we know an idea of how many korbanos an individual might bring throughout the course of a year?
An individual?
Yeah.
Well, it depends how many sins he committed.
Right.
I mean, listen, you as an individual, there's only one korban you as an individual have to bring every year, and that's the korban Pesach. That's not quite right. For the three pilgrimage festivals, you have to bring a korban for each of the pilgrimage festivals. So a person could get by, let's see, Olas v'yashalamim, two. Yeah, your minimum is seven offerings a year. Seven offerings a year is what you would bring. That's assuming you don't have any sin offerings. If you had sin offerings, that would have to be added. If your wife gave birth, that would be added as well, right? So, depending on the occasions, but a minimum of seven. Now, that's not quite true either, because those seven could be brought as family units. You didn't have to. In other words, the Korban Pesach, I could bring one Korban Pesach and have 20 people on that Korban Pesach. But I have to be part of that offering.
You have your hand in at least seven of them.
Right. But I have to have a partnership interest in seven offerings, yeah.
Why are there different blueprints for the different temples? Why don't they just have one for all of them?
Yeah, that is a very, very good question. The real question is, why is the third different than the first? The reason why the second is different, the Rambam explains, that the prophets knew that the second temple would be destroyed, and therefore they did not want it to be the permanent temple that the third one would be. Now that could be the same answer for the first, that it is the third temple that is the ideal model, that is God's will. And any temple that is going to be destroyed does not, by definition, have all of the features. So that would explain why the first and the second are different than the third. That doesn't explain why is the first and the second different from each other. That is a good question. But neither of them are the third, because the third is the ultimate temple that will come down from heaven and that will never be destroyed. And that is in the book of Yechezkel, right? The end of the Navi Yechezkel. Yechezkel was a prophet at the time of the Chorban, together with Jeremiah, with Yirmiyahu, and Yechezkel gives you a blueprint, mamash. Now, it's very difficult, because it's not a pictorial blueprint, it's a verbal blueprint, right? So, as you know from the Mishkan, verbal descriptions of pictures are very, very difficult. So, different people try to draw it, etc., but they draw it different ways, because there are different interpretations of what it is. Okay? Alrighty, so we'll see you tonight.